Hello, hello, everyone. Welcome to the STEM Powered Women Podcast. I'm your host, Brittany A.J. Maricki, the founder of Sisters in STEM. If you're new to our audience and don't really know who we are, Sisters in STEM is a multimedia platform aimed toward empowering women of color in their daily lives and their passion for science, technology, engineering, and math. I created this podcast to showcase empowered women. STEM-powered women. Today, we are joined by biologist and wildlife conservationist, Karina Newsom. You may have come across her many features on CNN, The Inquirer, New York Magazine, or one of her enthusiastic nature videos on her social platforms as the Hood Naturalist. I want you all to feel her joy for nature and understand a little bit about why she calls herself the Hood Naturalist. So let's get to it. Say hey, sis.
Hey, sis.
Hey. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Yay. It's so much fun getting a chance to talk with everyone who I've like connected with on social media and whatnot, because you'll see your videos and get excited about like, oh my gosh, I don't know what kind of snake that is or what kind of bug that is, but it got me excited. And then now I get to see the person behind it all.
I know. It's so great to finally have some in-person contact, at least virtually. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, virtually, of course. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do? Biologist, wildlife conservationist, two different things, but you have managed to merge them into your own creative way. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do, and then we'll walk through your journey to getting there.
Yeah, so my background in education is in zoo science specifically. So I've spent a lot of my time and career as a zookeeper. But recently, about 2 years ago, I transitioned out of that to go back to school. So now I am a master's biology student at Georgia Southern University. And my research that I'm conducting is focusing on the conservation of a bird called the seaside sparrow, which is a coastal marsh-dwelling bird. And so conservation is very important to me, and which is why the research that I do focuses on the conservation of a bird species. Birds are my favorite group of animals.
Nice. That's so cool. And how do you even come across so many of those different species? Is it just because that's where you are and you just manage to randomly see a snake, or you always know what specific bird type that you're seeing because you've studied them for so long?
Exactly. I don't think I'm necessarily around more wildlife than the average person, unless you're in the city, which is honestly where I'm from. But most people just are not aware of the diversity of wildlife that's living around them. And before I learned about it, even when I was out of the city, I didn't recognize or even notice wildlife, native wildlife in my space. So it wasn't until I was taught what to look for that I was able to find them. And that's why I get so much joy showing other people the species that they share their space with, so that when they go outside, they can have the tools to identify and notice them as well.
Nice. That's really cool. Because as you mentioned, you're from Philadelphia.
Yes.
I'm in Chicago. Uh-huh. I know when I look out the window, I'll see a bird, but I'm like, okay, cool. That's a nice bird. I may recognize the cardinal. That's our state bird. Besides that, I'm not really noticing a whole lot. So how is it that as a young one growing up in Philly that you were able to connect with that passion so deeply?
Well, I really fell in love with wildlife by looking at books and magazines, specifically National Geographic magazines. I was obsessed. And where I lived in Philadelphia, there was really not much wildlife around me at all. So I was never really exploring the outdoors to look for wildlife as a kid. It wasn't until I left Philadelphia and went to school. I went to Malone University in Canton, Ohio, and majored in zoo and wildlife biology. And part of that degree requirement is to take lots of different field classes that teach you about North American species. So mammalogy, study of mammals, herpetology, which is the study of reptiles and amphibians, and ornithology, which is the study of birds. And it wasn't until then that I was able to learn how to recognize and identify animals in my space. So it did take, you know, rigorous training to be able to learn that for me, but anyone can learn it. You don't have to go to college or take college courses to learn that. But the passion had been there since I was a kid, but the information, the knowledge about native wildlife did not actually come until I went to college.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. So what is it that you're doing on a day-to-day basis? So I know where your main research is on that particular bird. I won't repeat the name so that way I don't mess it up. But I'm curious what it is that you're actually doing, because are they going extinct? Why do we have to study a bird to learn more about it? Is that what people are out here doing? They're people who specifically study these animals to learn.
Yeah.
I think I'm just kind of having a revelation moment. If you could see my face, you can see me processing the information.
So there's like two different kinds of biology you can do. It's called basic biology, which doesn't mean it's simple. Basic biology means that you are studying an organism or an ecosystem, whatever. You're studying something to just learn about it, to know what it is. Mm-hmm. Applied biology, on the other hand, is research that focuses on basically conservation. You are learning and asking questions, answering questions for the purpose of applying that knowledge to do something for that species. And so the kind of research I'm doing is applied biology. And so the seaside sparrow, which is the species I'm studying, it's classified as climate endangered by the National Audubon Society. And that essentially means that climate change is going to pose a threat to its ability to survive in the future. And for this particular species, sea level rise is the main threat. They live on the coast, they build their nests in the marsh grass on the coast, and sea level rise increases the height of the high tide, which poses a threat to the seaside sparrow because they build their nest in the marsh grass. And if a high tide is higher than usual, higher than they expect, their nests will get flooded and they'll lose their offspring, which is not good. But they have a response to that. They are adapted to respond to that. So if they lose a nest to a flooding event, they will build another nest right away and build it higher in the grass so that they don't get flooded again. The problem, though, is that the higher you build your nest in the grass, the more exposed to predators you are. So they're really caught between a rock and a hard place. And so as biologists, we have to figure out, okay, what kinds of questions do we need to ask to, you know, employ wildlife management to save the species in the future? And so my research actually focuses on the nest predation side of that question, of that problem. And so what I'm trying to understand is if nest predation, the threat of nest predation, like the likelihood that your nests will get found by a predator, if that changes depending on where they are in the marsh, if you're closer to roads or if you're closer to water bodies, are you more likely to be found by a predator? Mm. And the reason why a question like that is important is because as the sea level rises, which unfortunately will also reduce the amount of marsh available to even live in, as sea level rises and creates these, you know, smaller habitats for seaside sparrows, one thing that managers can do is to reduce the access that predators have to certain parts of the marsh. And if they know where it's most likely to happen, where nest predation happens most often, they can focus their efforts in those more sensitive areas. So that's kind of how my research ties into conservation for this species.
Okay. So you're not going to interfere with how those birds operate because they're not trained, they're wild. So it's no way you can tell them based off of your research, like, hey, dude, don't build your nest over here. Like, you need to get a little bit further this way because this predator is going to get you. Or is there some way you can kind of set up little barriers that might help them navigate that way? Is that possible?
Well, what we're actually doing is focusing on the predators, not so much on the bird. So if we know, a lot of nest predation happens, say, within 100 meters of a road, we can prevent predators from going there. So we can keep predators from accessing that part of the marsh as opposed to trying to get seaside sparrows to nest somewhere else. So that's kind of where, in my mind, management could be most effective.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. So focus on what you kind of can control and just observe how nature works itself out.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm going to ask another mind-boggling moment. So obviously we're in the world of climate change and global warming, and that is what's causing the sea levels to rise, right? Mm-hmm. And it's directly affecting the species that you're focusing on.
Climate change has a variety of different impacts on wildlife. So for a coastal species like the seaside sparrow, sea level rise is one of the main issues. But for some, it's the temperature. Some birds, they can't tolerate certain temperatures over a certain threshold. And so they are going to start migrating further north where it's cooler as the temperature increases. But for some animals, it's a habitat issue, like sea level rise engulfing the marsh. So climate change has a variety of impacts on wildlife.
And that is something everyone needs to keep in mind as they're trying to be advocates for change when it comes to the global warming crisis that we're in. I do have a question about just your experience working in the field, because it's come to light right now, and this will kind of give the audience a little hint as to when we're recording this. This is Black Birders Week, which you had founded with a few other Black birders just across the nation, correct?
Yes, there's a group of about 30 of us.
Wow, 30, okay.
Yeah, so so essentially what happened was we had this massive group chat that was started by my friend Jason Ward of just a bunch of Black people in STEM who met each other online, and we're like, we want to be friends, like, because we're in all white spaces and we need each other. So he was like, let's make a group me. So there's a group me of like 100 people, right? We just encourage each other and have a great time, mm-hmm. Decompress, all those things. And so when the incident in Central Park happened with Christian Cooper, who is someone that many of us know and respect in the birding world, mm-hmm. one of the group members, her name is Anna, she was like, and she's actually an economist, so really not in the natural sciences, she was like, we need to do something to celebrate Black birders. And then everyone jumped on and was like, yes. And within 48 hours, an entire plan was concocted, and people mapped out a schedule for the week, people made graphics, people contacted the press. That was kind of what my job was. And there was so many moving parts that came together fairly seamlessly for how quickly it happened.
Yeah.
And we did it all in response to this incident, which is not isolated. And that's why we're here, because the experience that Christian had in Central Park is one that many of us have had and have often. And mm-hmm. the root of it being, of course, white supremacy and the centering of white resources, white life, white concerns, and putting everyone else's concerns and everyone else's life kind of in the margins. And that has reflected itself in many different ways in our career. So we said, this is the time, since everyone's finally paying attention to this intersection, to this topic, yeah. we need to make sure they know that this is not an isolated incident. This is a problem, and we are going to do something about it. And mm-hmm. so that's how we got here.
Nice. I respect that completely. Was he in the group chat with you guys to kind of relay that experience, and then all of a sudden just him kind of seeing it blow up on the news with everything, you know, with all the attention that it actually got?
So he's actually not in the group chat. He's not old, but all of us are like pretty young. We're like 30 and under. He doesn't do group chats. But we heard about it first. I heard about it first on the news, like, because it, you know, mm-hmm. at first it was just like his sister knew, and his sister kind of posted a video, and then it just like blew up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow. Oh my goodness. Can you speak to any experiences that you may have had? Because like we mentioned, it's not an isolated incident.
Right.
It's happening to all of you.
Mm-hmm. So I have been very fortunate to not have any racist experiences in the field birding. People have had directly racist experiences, like people mm-hmm. shouting out of their car at them, or people threatening them, and, you know, all kinds of things. That has not happened to me. What the thing that I relate to personally is the fact that I know that as a Black person, I make white people uncomfortable inherently. I recognize that. And I can't tell or predict the magnitude of that when I'm outside. And so I am constantly compensating for what I think is massive discomfort on the part of white people who see me outside. So if I'm on a trail by myself, I always make sure to have my binoculars very visible. So if someone's approaching, and I don't even have to see a bird, if they're approaching me, I put these binoculars up just like this. I don't have to be looking at nothing but a tree. I'm gonna have these binoculars up just like this. When I am, so, you know, when I'm just recreationally birding, when I'm doing yeah. my research in the marsh, the marsh that I'm studying, it's adjacent to roads where people can walk, drive, ride their bike. And mm-hmm. I'm working in Brunswick, Georgia, which is an extremely racist city. You have plantation mm-hmm. museums all over the place where they literally celebrate the good old days and have this revisionist. Yeah, they like my. I didn't go in, because if I go in,
wow,
I'm gonna get arrested. I'm gonna act out. But my advisor,
you can speak
who's
white, your truth on this show,
listen,
sis.
Listen, I can't go in there. But my advisor was like, if you need to get out some righteous anger, you can walk in. But she went in, and they were portraying slavery like, oh yes, the slaves were treated very well by their masters. And I'm like, what kind of revisionist mess is this? And the because it was a bunch of white people together, the people who worked there were saying all kinds of horrible things about black people to my advisor. And so before I took on this research project, because she knows I'm from Philly, I don't mess with none of this. No black people should. But she was like, I'm going to warn you. These are the kinds of people down here. I don't want you walking into this or signing up for this without being fully aware. So she told me, she gave me the lowdown. So I knew what I was getting into. But when I saw it for myself, it was just like, This sucks. You know, when I think about the culture of this place and that is already hostile, actively hostile to black people specifically, and I'm sure many others, but specifically to black people, I am like wildly uncomfortable being here. But then you have incidents like what happened to Ahmaud Arbery. He got shot down the road from my field site and I didn't even know about it until it hit the press, right? So it didn't even hit the press until 2 months after the incident. So I had no idea. Wow. And then I see the press releases and they show the picture of where it happened at this, you know, neighborhood called Satilla Shores. And I'm like, I literally drive by this place every day. Like every time I go to the field, the very next day that I went out there after this hit the news, I was like physically sick. I was like, there are several thoughts going through my mind. Like, firstly, like black men, I totally recognize as a light skinned female, my experience is not the same. The threat to my life is not the same as a dark skinned male. 100% understand that. But I'm like, I'm literally in a place that is actively dangerous for black people. And I'm just expected to focus on my research. And that kind of reality was very unsettling for me. And then the other part of that is that black people are being killed. And I'm out here looking at sparrows and I'm like, I should be doing, I'm like, I feel guilty doing something this quote, you know, leisurely, so to speak. Like it's obviously hard work, but it's not directly addressing systemic racism, white supremacy. And it's like this feeling of guilt. And so it's just like, it's the culture of white supremacy and the root of white supremacy has manifested itself in the lives of black people in the natural sciences in many different ways, whether it's direct threat to their life, this, you know, just the inability to just be at peace outside or like disorienting us and like impacting the ability for us to do our research in peace. Like it's so it has many different faces. And so this Black Birders Week was a chance to for all of us to tell our stories about this is how white supremacy manifests in our lives. And the reason why it's important and the reason why it's so important that it's hit the press like this and that organizations like the National Audubon Society, which is a bird, massive bird conservation organization, was had our backs and was supporting us and declaring what we were declaring is that whenever we share our experiences, whenever we try to bring our concerns to the community of birders and outdoor explorers, they shut us down and tell us you're being too political. We can't have that conversation. And it happens.
What?
I cannot even tell you the number of times that's happened to me. And it happened this week multiple times too. And like, if we can't even get our message out because you are silencing us, you are censoring us before it can even hit anyone's ears, this is just going to continue. And so to have these massive organizations stand up and declare our messages over the barriers that we have not personally been able to overcome because we've been silenced as individuals. But if the overarching organizations are forcing that message to their constituents, that is powerful. And so that's really what's been happening with Black Birders Week and why it's been such an important movement.
Wow. The Black Birders Week is very, very important, as you pointed out. And I appreciate you for making the connection of your work to your location and also like what your experience has been in that area to kind of paint a better picture of where Ahmaud Arbery was when he was murdered.
Right.
It's leaving me speechless because just hearing the fact that you guys have plantation museums and that's just the mindset of the people that live within that town. That's what he had to deal with. And he can't even just take a jog through a simple neighborhood. Yep. Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
So.
And the sad thing is like Brunswick Brunswick is like so beautiful. Like it's like just full of trees, Spanish moss, marsh everywhere, birds everywhere. It's like the place you would want to go to explore the outdoors, but it's don't go there. It's like a no-go zone. You know what I mean? Which is horrible.
That's really crazy. So as someone who does have that passion for nature, how do you make sure that you don't have that fear instilled in you knowing that where I'm going probably isn't safe for me, but I do enjoy doing this. So that way the person who already has that passion or someone who may develop a passion for it would still want to pursue that because I wouldn't even want to, like you said, you had to make that conscious decision to go to this racist area to pursue something that you loved. That was a very strong decision.
Mm-hmm. I would say, I think another reason why this week has been so important for me personally is that I honestly, I didn't know what to do. I was stuck. I was like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with the reality that I'm living in and that Black mm-hmm. people are living in and my passion. Because if it was up to me, I would pack up and leave and go work at Home Depot. Like, shoot, right? But this week, what's important, what needs to happen and what has happened this week and I hope continues to happen is that Black people need to see other Black people doing this.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to see that it is possible and it is okay and it is the right thing to do for Black people to be out here. I don't have to feel guilty for studying birds. I don't have to feel guilty for choosing to do this passion of mine as opposed to, you know, I don't know, working in civic engagement or something that seems maybe more directly related to social justice. And that we belong out here because it definitely feels like when I'm out there and I have pickup trucks pulling off the side of the road and up next to the marsh and looking at me, you know, through their window, I feel like, okay, I can't, the feeling that I feel is like, I don't belong out here. Not in that, you know, I'm inherently not supposed to be out here, but the space is one that makes me highly uncomfortable. Therefore, I should not be out here. Mm-hmm. Seeing a bunch of Black people, thousands and thousands and thousands of Black people doing the very same thing I'm doing tells me that I'm not alone. Even if I'm physically the only Black person in the space that I'm in, I'm actually not alone. And that is what has encouraged me to continue going back outside and going back and researching. And so if you're a Black person that's interested in outdoor exploration, outdoor sciences, natural sciences, it is very important that you connect with other Black people. Very, trust me, because you will almost always, you can't fix everybody. You can't fix all the white people. You can't force anyone to not be racist. You can't force anyone to not be dangerous to Black people, right? But you need to have a network of Black people who are doing the same thing as you so that you can be encouraged and you can be reminded that the space is yours as well, and to thrive and be your best self out there. So don't turn away. Like, again, I don't want to paint a picture of this can't, you know, this space is not for Black people should run. That's not what I want to say. What I want to say, what I want to encourage you to do is to move towards other Black people and find Black community.
So that way you can have that, like you said, have that sense of community to help encourage, you know, this is where I belong. I'm not alone. I can do this. And I'm curious, how is the climate when it comes to women within that field as well? Because we all know STEM is a male dominated space. And we're still trying to show, wait, we in here.
That's right.
So I'm curious, how many women do you come across? Because you just, the person you work with at your research facility is a woman, right?
Yes, she is. So my advisor is a woman. Yeah, which is huge, huge on many different fronts. She's not Black, but she is a woman. And it is male dominated. And I think that women have had to work very hard to prove themselves. And especially in a field like natural sciences that is very like physical in nature, it's like women can, you know, sometimes be treated as like frail or like incapable physically or even mentally. And I have personally felt the need to kind of like go out of my way to be a very forceful person in my academic space and to make sure that people don't think for a second that I'm not capable. So I go above and beyond to do that. And I feel like, again, another situation in which I overcompensate. But I think it's important for me to see other women doing this for the same reason it's important for me to see other Black people doing this. So especially Black women, because it reminds you, not that you think that you're incapable, but when all you see is people not like you and all you see is people like you being excluded, it can be very damaging to the soul. I go out of my way to find Black women in this space. And the beauty of social media, and again, one reason why Black Birders Week has been so helpful, is that you can just type a hashtag in and find people. Hashtag Black women in the outdoors, hashtag Black in, you know, Black in nature, whatever. And tomorrow we're actually highlighting Black women in birding specifically as our like final push for the week of events. And so it is very important. Representation is kind of the name of the game. Seeing people being able to see themselves represented in all of their identities in the space they want to be part of.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love it completely. And that's why I wanted to make sure I supported you guys with it. I posted my little bird picture that I had taken in, where was I? The Bahamas. Because every time we go on a vacation, my mom loves to make sure that we go to something that's like nature-based. We'll do our fun excursions where we'll, you know, go in the water, go ziplining, all that different stuff. But we'll oftentimes go to like the local farms that they have. And they had this one conservation center. And they had the flamingos out there, literally roaming
thing, and they would like come right up to you. There was a peacock that was very, very mad. But the little birdie that I took a picture with was so sweet. Obviously, she only wanted the apple that was in my hand. And when I posted the picture on the Sisters in STEM Instagram page, I got all these birders started to follow me. And I'm like, wait, hold up. This is not a bird page, but I support them. I'm like, they'll find out. They'll find out after I continue to post more things.
It's so funny. That's been like what everyone's story is like. I just got like a bunch of birders following me. They're going to be mad when I'm posting more birds. But no, it's good. Like it's like that. And that's, I think that intersectionality that like people who aren't even career or even like necessarily classified as nature enthusiasts can enjoy the outdoors. And that's part of the point. That's important for me personally to see that. So
yeah. I love it so much. What was your experience as a zookeeper? Because I'm sure you had to come across so many young little kids and they're looking up to you, seeing you being the Black woman zookeeper. And like, oh my gosh, mom, I want to be like her. What was your experience in that field?
Yeah, because I'm only in wildlife sciences, period, because a Black woman zookeeper reached out to me when I was in high school and said, hey, you should come intern at the Philadelphia Zoo and come behind the scenes with me. She was the lead carnivore keeper, which is like the keeper job to have, right? Like the BA, right? So I was like, oh, and after I saw what she does and saw her work, I was like, oh shoot, I didn't know this was here. I didn't know I could do this. And that's why I'm here today, because I was exposed and represented at the same time. Nice. So when I got to be a zookeeper, I had a lot of parents come up to me and be like, can I get your email? Like my daughter is interested in, you know, what you're doing. Can you tell me how you got here? Like a lot of people were doing that. And I realized it's very important, not only that kids get exposed to the career field, but they see me doing it specifically. I was the only Black zookeeper at the entire zoo. At the Nashville Zoo. Yeah. And the only Black, I think I might've been the only Black keeper at the previous zoo that I worked at too. I'm usually the only Black person in my spaces. And so it was important that kids see me doing this work. And so I was able to start a formal program at the Nashville Zoo called Pathway to Animal Care Careers. And I basically like wrote a program, an educational program that reached out to Nashville City high school students, targeting, you know, people from low-income backgrounds and people of color, kids of color. They would, you know, write a little essay, say why they wanted to come to the zoo, and they would come and spend a day with me participating in all the keeper activities, from cleaning to making food and diets for the animals to animal training, animal shows, outreach education, all the kind of realms that I did as a keeper, as well as go behind the scenes at the veterinary hospital, at the big old kitchen called the commissary at the zoo, to see the breeding areas for endangered species, to see as many things as they could, to give them both an exposure to the vast number of careers you can have in animal care and animal science, as well as to see someone like them doing it. So because I know and I have personally experienced, and I'm here as a result of representation, I have tried to establish programs, and I made another one at my old school as well, established programs that intentionally exist for the purpose of providing students windows and mirrors, so to speak, you know, exposure and reflection of themselves.
Nice. That seems like a dream for any kid, because I've gone to the zoo plenty of times, but to take that back behind the scenes, backstage, like close up with the animals, that's what you all wish that we could do. Like you're just looking through the glass, and that seems like an amazing opportunity. And it's awesome that you created that for the kids. It was high school age too, or was it just like
just high school?
Just high school. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is so awesome. So I'm curious, as someone who, you know, I'll look up at the sky and observe the birds, as long as nature doesn't get too close to me, I love it. I love to look at it from afar.
Sure.
But sure, I'm curious, how can people get involved if they're, you know, whether they do already have that passion or if they have an undiscovered passion for it, how can they get involved in being a wildlife conservationist or just being a naturalist overall?
I think that if you're someone who's already interested in the outdoors, but you haven't really explored it, I would encourage you to get to know the space that you're in, get to know the natural world where you live. And granted, if you are in the city, I grew up in the city, so I know what it's like to really not have access to spaces like that. But if you do have if you live in a city and you don't necessarily have access to green space, like in the immediate area where you live, look up patches of green space, little areas where there is wildlife in your region. And you can actually, this is much easier to do now than when I was a kid. You can literally just like Google. Most cities have parks or nature preserves, no matter how big or small, of some kind. And I would encourage you to travel there and just look closely. One of the basically the magic of being a scientist or an explorer or anything is that no matter how close or far away you are looking at the natural world, there's always something new to see. I can be looking, you know, have a big kind of extent view looking at, you know, an entire forest and be like, wow, there's so many different kinds of trees, so many different kinds of birds flying around, you know, see all this diversity. Or I can look at the bark of a tree this close and see so many insects, so many different, you know, lichen. I can see yep. all kinds of life teeming at any scale. And so if you're interested, there are lots of like apps and easy to access like resources to help you identify stuff. Because when you go mm-hmm. outside, if you've never paid attention to it before, there's going to be a lot you just don't know. And it can be feel daunting to learn what you're looking at. And so when it comes to birds in particular, I would encourage you to download the Audubon app, which is this really easy app. So if you see a bird, right, and it's, you know, about this big and it has maybe a tuft of feathers on the top of its head, you can go into the app and the first question it will ask you is like, what is the overall shape of this bird? And it has like silhouettes of different kinds of birds, like different families of birds. And you select the one that kind of looks like the one you're looking at. And then it'll say, you know, how big or what, select all the colors you see. It'll narrow it down for you. And then it will use your geographic location and present you with a bunch of different options of the birds that it could be. And usually by the time you've entered all that information, it's down to just a few. And that way you can say, oh, that was a northern cardinal. You know what I mean? And once you see that, I would encourage you to learn as much as you can about the northern cardinal. What does it eat? Where does it nest? You know, what's its behavior like? And as you kind of deepen your knowledge of individual species, it's easier to look closely and kind of like ping your interest about the rest of the species that are out there. iNaturalist is another really cool app that helps you identify anything, bugs, plants, birds, mammals. You take a picture and it will pull up an ID for you. Very, very easy to use. So if you're someone interested in like recreational exploration, that is definitely what I would recommend, is getting apps, Audubon, iNaturalist, to help you identify things. If you're someone interested in a career in conservation and kind of taking like a bigger step to outdoor exploration, it's important that you kind of see what's out there, expose yourself. And it can be difficult for people who are, again, low income or from the city, and you're not really, you don't have access mm-hmm. to those kinds of spaces. So I would use your networks. Again, especially if you're Black people in the sciences, like myself, I'm always ready to be a source of connection for anyone looking for it. If you need to find a marine biologist, I got you. If you need to find an ornithologist, I got you. If you're looking for a plant biologist, I got you. Volcanologist, I got you. Like, I know so many people, and a lot of Black people in these spaces know so many people. And so I would encourage you to network, email, you know, Google. If you're interested in birds in particular or mammals, just go ahead and Google, you know, mammal scientists, bird scientists. And if you're looking for Black people, you can go ahead and Google Black bird scientists too. And you might find, even social media is good for that. Again, hashtag, you know, Black biologists, hashtag Black and Outdoors will help you find all kinds of people. But reach mm-hmm. out to them, network, say, hey, is it possible for me to join you? Or do you have someone I can connect with that's in my area? I can see what they do. And as you kind of expose yourself to, you know, what it really looks like to be a marine biologist, what it really looks like to be an ornithologist, you can kind of choose your path from there. But finding ways to get some experiential learning is very important. So I would encourage you to reach out to professionals, network, and find experiences wherever you can, because especially the Black scientists in this field are always looking for ways to bring more Black students. Regardless of whether or not you're interested in recreation or profession, if you're interested in profession, network. If you're interested in recreation, download those apps and start identifying stuff. It'll make life so much more exciting.
And that's so cool that you point those things out, because I've done all of those things. I've seen a bird and I'll go online and I'll look it up like, oh, I wonder what this is. Because funny story, the job I was previously in would have me go out into far out areas for utility purposes. And when I was on this really long road, there were some birds up ahead that just looked so large. I couldn't tell what they were. And I thought it was a chicken. And I was just like, oh, somebody's chickens got out the coop. And as I kept getting closer and closer, I'm like, okay, that's way bigger than a chicken. I don't know what this is. So I kept driving and driving. And by the time I got so close, they had flown away. But I saw how big the wingspan was. And all I did was I typed into Google like what I saw. And turns out it was a turkey vulture. So it was a vulture.
I was literally about to say, I think you probably saw turkey vultures. Yes. That's awesome.
I thought that was so cool. I was like, oh my God, there's actual vultures here. I thought that was something that you see in the desert somewhere or on somebody's cartoon.
Mm-hmm. Yep, everywhere. And thank God they are too. Cleaning up for us. Cleaning up.
That's exactly what that's why there was so many of them in the road, because there was, you know, roadkill there and they were just going at it. I'm like, ooh. I had to swerve my truck around it so I wouldn't run over whatever they were picking at. I thought that was so crazy.
Right, right.
And then another funny thing is, I don't know if you listen to the Jhené Aiko new album, and she has that song called Morning Doves.
I haven't. I have to find it now. Okay.
She has the song and she mimics how the birds sing, and she was like, ooh, ooh. Ooh, ooh. And then she took a sample of them doing their ooh, 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 ooh. I was like, that's what I've been hearing my whole life. I've heard those things. I thought it was just an owl in the hood. I didn't know what it was.
That is, first of all, I am so hyped that Jhené Aiko was using mourning doves in her song.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I have had people many times, so many text messages, voice messages, Karina, this is what I'm hearing. And ooh, ooh, ooh. Is that an owl? And I'm like, nope, that's a mourning dove. They sound like owl. That's a mourning dove. Oh, I love it. I love it.
In my head, like all throughout childhood, I'm just like, yeah, it's just a hood owl. I don't know what it is. I've never seen it. I just always hear it. And it's around like spring, summertime. And then I looked up all the information about it. Like, this is the sound that they make when they're trying to mate. And that blew my mind, because I didn't realize that that's what I've been hearing my whole life.
No one expects it. No one expects the morning dove.
Yeah. And I even watched a TV show and I heard them in the background of that TV show. And I realized, I'm like, so they're recording around this time because it's mating season for those birds. So if you pay attention, birds are, you know, they make so many different connections to just the simple things in life.
They really do. It's a joy. They bring lots of joy.
Yeah. You were pointing out different things that people can do, you know, if they have that interest. And me as a traveler, I'm curious, where can people go? Like, what are your top three destinations if someone who wants to like get bask in nature and see the different animals or birds in particular too?
Yeah. So for birds specifically, the best time of year to see as many birds as you possibly can is during spring migration, during migration season, because there are literally billions of birds flying up from South America through North America. And on the way, they're stopping over in certain sites pretty predictably to like take a break, take a rest, eat some food. And one of the biggest places they do that is on the shore of Lake Erie, because as birds are kind of flying up across North America, a lot of them will stop and take a break before they journey across that massive lake. And so if you go to Ohio, to a place called McGee Marsh, doesn't sound like much, doesn't sound like even attractive, you will see literally so many, hundreds of bird species there. It is, oh my gosh, highly recommend going there. If you're looking for some of the bigger birds, so a lot of the birds you'll see at McGee Marsh are some of the smaller like warblers and like super colorful songbirds. You see all kinds of birds, but most of them are those songbirds. For like the larger like water birds, like wading birds, for example, like herons and egrets, and then, you know, roseate spoonbills, that are those bright pink birds, like the spoon-shaped bill, of course. If you go to the southeastern United States, whether you're on the coast of Georgia or the coast of Florida, you see literally so many different kinds of water birds. It will blow you away. And during the breeding season, those same like wading birds, they nest actually in trees. So you usually see them when they're living their regular lives, they're in the water, they're on the ground. But during the breeding season, they will fly up to high trees and build massive nests together. So if you want to go during the spring and summer to see what are called rookeries, massive groups of breeding birds, you want to go to Georgia or Florida on the coast. It will absolutely blow your mind.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, for a third place, that's tougher. But I would have to say that Alaska, which is a faraway place, I had the absolute privilege of going to Anchorage, Alaska, and everything is bigger in Alaska. It's true, including the eagles. I saw golden eagles. I saw Arctic terns, which make the longest migrations of all birds on the planet. They will They will fly like several million miles in their lifetime.
Wow.
They're incredible birds. You can also see incredible marine mammal life. So I saw beluga whales, and you could see gray, all kinds of whales on the coast of Alaska. So I would go to Alaska to see the big stuff. The big stuff, the cool stuff. So those are kind of my three destinations: McGee Marsh in Ohio, the coast of Georgia and Florida, and Alaska.
Nice. That is so, so cool. Now, mm-hmm. I want to debunk a myth, because I have seen baby birds that have fallen out of the nest. Mm-hmm. Is it true that the mama bird will not want to bring the, like, will not want the baby back after it's fallen out of the nest?
That is not true. In fact, I oftentimes will ban baby birds. So we'll take baby birds out of the nest, put little anklets, little bracelets on their legs, and put them back, and they continue to be cared for. So that is not true. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Because mm-hmm. I had a baby bird's fall out, and the nest was literally like right there by the door of an apartment that I had in Houston. And the neighbors, they put the bird back up there, but then the next day it was kicked right back out. And I'm like, is the bird trying to fly? Or are they kicking the bird out because the mom's like, you were touched by a human. I don't want you anymore. I disown you.
If that bird was back out of the nest, that's a fledgling. So birds, once they reach a certain stage of development in the nest, and they've got like a couple, you know, like a lot of feathers on, but they really can't quite fly yet, mm-hmm. they will jump out of the nest, and they still won't be able to fly. So you'll see them like hopping around on the ground, but the parents are always following them. So the parents are always like perched up in a tree watching them, still feeding them. But that is actually a very important part of their development, is learning how to build the strength of their wings and legs and their body strength in general. And they will spend several days on the ground unable to fly, and they look like they are in distress, but that's just part of the process.
Huh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. That's really cool. You have experienced so many bird types and fun topics of like when it just comes to animals in general. And I think that's really cool, because some of us will, you know, we live in just the human world and forget that we're surrounded by a much bigger world than just our humankind. And I think it's awesome that you take the time to do that research and push forward. And I hope that so many others are inspired to take that on themselves. Go for that research and looking to something new, because this is an area where, yeah, if you have a passion, it could possibly be a career. And that's something that I would encourage all of our young sisters and sisters who are, you know, not sure about where they want to go, look into it, because that just may be for you.
Definitely. And I want to say one last thing. If you're in college, like if you're college age and you're trying to figure out what to do, and you're interested in conservation research or like conservation biology, find ways to do internships. If you want to do animal care, look at your local zoo and find the summer internships they offer. And during your summers, get experience. And if you are someone who wants to do research, while you're in college, find professors who do the kind of research you're interested in and ask to help out with the research, or even do your own whole project, you know, depending on how much commitment you want. But be involved with that research so that by the time you graduate, you are equipped with not only education, but you're equipped with experience that is important to make you a cut above the rest and get you ahead and make sure you have all the skills you need to be successful in that field. And it's fun to do. Oh my goodness. It's not like it's like an extra burden. It's so much fun. It makes college so much more fun and so much more worth it. So highly recommend that.
Would you say that within this like career that it's like, oh my God, it's so much work, or every day is like a party because you're just, or every day is boring because you get a little lonely?
I would say there can be a mix of a little bit of all of that, but the overwhelming feeling is gratitude. So I'll be out there in the marsh, and it's extremely harsh. I mean, I would not recommend doing research in the marsh if you don't like actually being stripped to your bone. But like, I'll be like chugging in the marsh, like constantly pulling my feet out of mud. I'm sweating. I have bugs like biting me. There's no shade. You know, I'm like, Jesus, sustain me. But then I find a nest of seaside sparrows and I see babies inside. And I'm like, yes, like this is, you know, even though I'm literally covered in like salt from the marsh, you know what I mean? Even though I'm like physically so uncomfortable, I would literally not rather be doing anything else. So no matter what you end up feeling, there will be discomforts of all kinds, whether it's socially because you are maybe in an area with people who have not come to appreciate diversity yet, or you are physically like exhausted, whatever it might be. When you love what you're doing and what you're studying, the joy of participating in it and seeing what you're looking for, finding what you're looking for, discovery, that so overwhelms the rest of it that it's like, you always come back. You love it and you can't wait to come back. So even though at the end of the day, I'm dead tired. I'm like, oh, no one talk to me. I can't wait to go back out again. So that's kind of what it looks like for me.
And if you have ever watched one of her videos, you will feel that same excitement because I'm like, oh my gosh, she caught this on camera. I'm so happy for her. Or, oh my gosh, she saw that animal. I know she's been looking for it forever. Oh, I'm so happy for her. So you convey that same excitement and I can tell just how much you love it. We all need to feel that kind of love in our careers.
Yes. And I'm so grateful to feel it because not everybody does, you know, like some people end up in careers they don't like. So that's why I always encourage people to find what you love and figure out how to make it be the mm-hmm. thing that makes you money, you know?
Yes. Agreed. Well, I want to thank you so much again for joining me. It was a pleasure chit-chatting with you and getting to learn a little bit more about what you do. I know we got a little heavy, but I'm glad we were able to bring it back to a happier note because we're in such a critical time right now. So I'm glad you were able to shed a light on what your experience was. But I also hope that people were able to take more from the conversation that, you know, related to diversity in these spaces and showing that representation is truly, truly important. And yes. I appreciate you for being in the space that you are and creating the platform that you do because it's awesome. I love
it. Thank you so much. And I'm so grateful that there is an organization like yours that is like focusing on empowering women. That is just so needed. And just as much as like the things that surrounding like Black people in particular is so critical right now. People seeing themselves represented has been so forgotten about in the past, has not even considered in the past. And now mm-hmm. it is. And people like you are making that happen. So I'm eternally grateful to you. Thank you. And thank you for letting me be on here.
Yes. Is there anything that you would like to plug your project, tell people about that you have coming up?
Well, I would just encourage you to, if you're interested in what I have to say or the things that I do, to follow me on Instagram or Twitter at @HoodNaturalist, @Hood_naturalist on Twitter and @Hood_naturalist on Instagram. But I am in the kind of end stages of my research. And then after that, I'll be publishing it and sharing what I found with the world. And so I hope you will be around to see it.
Yay! Thank you so much again.
Thank you for tuning into another episode of the STEM-Powered Women Podcast. I hope you learned something from our discussion that you'll be able to share with others. Visit sistersinstem.org for podcast episodes, stories and advice from your sisters, and much more. Make sure you follow us at The Sisters in STEM on all social media. You can also find me on Instagram at Brittany A. Joy. Whether you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your shows, please subscribe so you'll know exactly when a new episode drops. And while you're at it, go ahead and give us 5 stars and leave an awesome review to show your sister some love. Remember, sis, you are an empowered woman, a STEM-powered woman. You've got this. I'll see you on the next one. Bye.